From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
I'm really excited about this because I can see a potential for me hauling one of my kids home and take over that farm. Because, you know, it'd be nice to have sixth generation on there. I'm excited about maybe there is a future for my family, because if this does not work, I guarantee as soon as they plant me, the farm's for sale.
Welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. This show is heard on radio stations around the world, including CHUO Ottawa and CHSR Fredericton. I'm John Steinman. Without too much time passing since we aired part two of our ongoing series titled The Local Grain Revolution, today we air part three. Since March 2008, this series has been documenting the creation of Canada's first community-supported agriculture, or CSA, project for grain. For part two, we joined the first farm tour, where CSA members from Nelson and Creston, British Columbia, descended onto three farmers in the Creston Valley, who were, throughout the 2008 growing season, cultivating grains for local consumption, a rather revolutionary yet surprisingly simple project. Now, because one of the goals of this series is to create a resource for other communities who may be inspired to take on a similar project, on today's part three, we'll listen in on segments from the July 14th meeting of the CSA Steering Committee. The meeting took place the day after the CSA tour that we listened in on part two, and hopefully the segments will lend a better idea of what it takes for a community to begin working with farmers to supply locally grown grains. We'll also visit with Nelson resident and volunteer extraordinaire, David Everest, who upon hearing about the CSA's formation in 2007, stepped forward and volunteered to become the local miller so that members could get freshly milled grain upon request. David is in the process of constructing a shed in his Nelson backyard where the mill will be located. And what's now generating incredible excitement throughout the community is a group of people who have come forward and offered to also be part of this exciting initiative, and that is a group of sailors. You see, Creston is a good hour and 45-minute drive from Nelson, but both the Creston Valley and Nelson are connected by Kootenai Lake, one of the larger inland lakes in the province. And so we'll hear from someone from the Kootenai Lake Sailing Association, who upon learning about the CSA, gathered a group of other sailing enthusiasts to sail some of the grain from Creston to Nelson, and in doing so, reduce the fossil fuel requirements of this exciting and blossoming local food system. Another quick reminder that if you do use the internet and have a Facebook account, Deconstructing Dinner does now maintain a presence on Facebook, and we've made a link to our Facebook page from our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. It's also important to acknowledge that today's broadcast is being recorded on World Food Day, October 16th, and so a happy World Food Day to everyone listening in. So back on part one of this Local Grain Revolution series, we did listen in on segments from the first CSA meeting that took place in December of 2007. The group convened once again on July 14th. And I can say from a personal note that how exciting it has been actually being able to sit in on these meetings and not only record the dialogue taking place, but to also be a part of it. Now, we won't get around to hearing all of the important discussion that ensued at that meeting, but you can be assured we'll get to it in upcoming weeks when we air part four and five of this series. So there were about a dozen of us sitting around a table in Creston to discuss the current and future direction of the Nelson-Creston Grain CSA. The three farmers were, of course, in the room, Keith Huscroft, Drew Galeas, and Roy Lawrence, along with his wife, Sherry. Also in the room were CSA coordinators Matt Lowe, Brenda Bruns, and Donna Carlisle, the Creston Food Action Coalition's Gail Southall, food shed animator and familiar voice on Deconstructing Dinner, Abra Brin, the Kootenai Bakery Cooperative's Cindy Olivis, and Karen Powis, who is helping document the CSA's evolution. Among the many items on the agenda, the first item was with respect to the organic growing practices being used by the farmers. One of the three farmers, as an example, is using the CSA as a way for him to help ease the transition from conventional practices to natural ones. And this year, all three farmers were growing crops that they had never grown before. So there were a lot of new experiences all around. And one of the concerns was, of course, weeds, and whether or not weeds were, all that at the time of the meeting, posing a problem. In the following discussion, we learn how important long-term forecasting is when growing naturally. In this segment, you'll hear from Keith Huscroft, Drew Galeas, and Abra Brin.
So the first item we wanted to talk about for the short term is the weeds in the grain that we are now growing. Are weeds an issue in any way whatsoever?
They were this for me this year, but they won't be next year. Just because of the short notice that I had. Last year I planted grain in the same field twice, so the first year you can get a good control of them, but the second year, because you can't get a cover, or I didn't have any cover crop or anything, I have a lot of weeds in with my grains, but I also have a lot of grain. So all it is just one more process, an extra process in harvesting. You have to cut it ahead of time and then have the combine pick it up. I don't see any problems. And by next year, it won't be an issue for me.
I think the same thing as Keith, that the weeds are there. And until you grow a crop sort of to suppress the weeds a year before and plow it under, kind of work with that, but you're always having to work a year or two ahead all the time, which is kind of hard for me anyway. I'm finding to do that ahead of time, get enough time ahead, and that's the way to control the weeds.
The weed problem really is not so much for the consumers. The weed problem really is that as a farmer, you look at the weed as something that's taking the nutrients out of your ground.
Right. Yeah.
It's robbing you, so you want to get rid of the weeds. And weeds are a long-term thing. Like wild oats, that seed will stay in the ground and will germinate 20 years later.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a long-term thing that you're looking at.
Yes. Yeah. Which we had a tremendous flush of this one type of weed. And it was just ground and plowed, and it would never have that weed in it at all. But somehow, when we flipped it over, it just released this weed, and it just all of us, it must have been just ready to have to sprout, and away it went.
So, if I can address the B1B, what do we tell investors? Like, I really do think this is an important opportunity for us to do the education of the consumers, because they don't have a clue that weed management, particularly with grain crops, is a long-term issue. And you know, and that the weeds basically are taken from the soil, so you're always trying to find that a way to manage them so that you get a good crop. So, you know, most of the CSAs that I know do have a regular newsletter, and I'm not suggesting that we offload that on you guys, but amongst the various people who are supporting this, even amongst the membership, there may be people who'd be willing to pull together some kind of newsletter, and it certainly doesn't have to be fancy. I've seen a lot of them, they're still done on typewriters. But, you know, someone who's got a computer could throw together a monthly little newsletter that tells the members some of the basics about growing. They learned a lot on that tour, but that was probably only half the shareholders, and they need to learn more. So I think it would be useful to do that.
Well, I still have your book.
You got it?
Yes. And in there, they all talk about, you know, with organic farming of grains, weeds are a problem. You know, weeds are your big thing because you're letting them go. The grain's growing and growing and growing. You're not getting on and cutting it early or anything. And so that is one of the biggest things to deal with. And that has to be dealt with you know, cover crops, green manures, plow down, stuff like that.
Yeah, and like you were just saying, you need enough lead time.
And you're always got to be working a year or two ahead.
Mm-hmm. But you know, the exciting thing for me is like the fact that we've got people bugging mad about what's happening next year means that it's not just the farmers who are looking ahead, but the consumers are actually starting to think ahead. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think this is just, it's a really fertile time for us to be doing that kind of education. And I've got a bunch of Drew wheat, and you know, there's stuff in it. I just throw it all in the hopper and grind it up. It's just fine. So I think we've got a pretty tolerant and excited shareholder group, and doing that education is going to just increase that tolerance and support, I think.
Generally, no, your wheat's going to be clean. There's not going to be any weed seeds after we clean it, because if we see any, we'll clean it again. But I mean,
but that's
theoretically speaking,
or
whatever it is. When we go to seed, we don't want anything else. We check our product. You know, yeah. If you're there when we're cleaning the seed, you can see how it works. But just to, you know, nothing gets through, especially the small weed seed. Weed seeds tend to be very small.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner. As the Grain CSA discussion continued, one unexpected barrier was also discussed. Shortly after the seeds went into the ground, it was discovered that spelt has a much harder hull than the more commonly grown varieties of wheat, and the spelt was therefore going to require special equipment to de-hull the grains. and with no equipment of that kind in the Creston Valley, it was decided at the meeting that the spelt could be brought to a group in the Okanagan Valley of the province who was willing to take the task on. Now, since the July meeting, the three farmers were somehow able to dehull the majority of the harvested spelt with the equipment they did have, and so the trip to the Okanagan was never required. Also brought up at the July meeting was another important topic regarding whether or not the grains grown on the three different farms should be blended or remain separate and thereby the product of an individual farm.
Sorry. Would it make sense, though, to like have all, because I've seen your bins, would it make sense for all the wheat to go to your place?
No, because we have to keep it separate because aren't we going to put our own labels on our own product so they know which farm it came from?
We had hoped for that.
Yeah.
Just to have the face of the farmer with the food that people are eating, really connecting people with the food.
The unfortunate thing about that, though, is if you can combine the wheat, you'll wind up with a better wheat product.
Than having two, because of the various gluten contents.
Well, I can see the advantage of keeping them separate, and I can see the advantage to...
The only problem is that I don't have any, or I really didn't figure on transporting anything off the farm. Right. And I'm self-sufficient on the cleaner. And I'm not worried about using Drew's or Gordon's, though if it turns out to be a whiz-bang and we can figure out how to sack it all in 25 minutes, it's going to go there. Because it's going to take me a week or two to do all my grain.
You won't really be blending them anyways, to my way of thinking, and because when you put things in, they're going to come out the same way, and you're probably going to have a lot of the one product going through, even if you tried to put them all in the bin.
Well, I'm thinking, Drew, yeah. Say, did all three of you grow red fife?
Yeah.
So if the shareholder is going to get red fife, are they going to get yours, Roy's, or Keith's, or are they going to get a blend of all three?
No, they're going to get... Because even like Drew said,
one of three.
You're not going to be able to lift up three tote bags and put one of each guy's. Blending is probably easier done at the bakery with one of each bag of everybody's or a bag of each other's product.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because for us to hold up three tote bags and have a steady stream of the equal amount of each grain to give an equal blend
Isn't
something we can do.
Then if you do a blend, what comes to mind is that's another machinery. Isn't it a piece of machinery? Because you dump all these in to a bin and then
you'd have to take it to Sunset Seed, you'd have to put it through a mixer.
And we would want to do that because it would be contaminated. You know, like we're trying to keep this organic.
Really, really, really clean.
Yeah.
So it strikes me then for this year, the consumer will get a bag that's labeled with which farm, and perhaps because their bin at the end is going to have four products, we can try to make sure that we have at least one bag of product from each farm going into it, so they might get, you know, your Hard Red Spring, and somebody would get your, and in most cases, I mean, we've got all the spelt coming from Roy's. Is that am I correct on that? Yes. Mm-hmm. So it may be not too big of a challenge to put something from each farm in each bin. And then, you know, we'll see how that works.
And I think part of the reason why we are doing this a little bit is because to see what areas grow which product better in a way.
Yet another important logistical issue discussed at the meeting was packaging. It was decided early on that for the first year of the Grain CSA, members would receive their grain in individual bags. This and other related issues were discussed at the meeting.
Right, so I'm hoping to order the 10 kilogram, the 22 pound bags.
Right.
And we're going to need, I'm thinking, a minimum of about 1,200 bags.
Right.
And then Drew, you and Joanne had come up with labels already. Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask if you could help Keith and Sherry so that we have some sort of consistency, but of course everyone will have a different label, but does that make sense?
Yeah, we just went to Imagine Inc.
Oh, okay. And it's also an interesting opportunity if two neighbors happen to get two different farmers' wheat, then they can share. And I really, on the bulletin board for the website, I really wanted to give people the opportunity to chat with each other. I've had a lot of people, as they send in their checks, say, well, I really am not going to use the spelt, so could I get extra this? And I've been saying to people, no, I'm sorry, you get your bin. But, you know, you may find, because I'm finding some people don't want spelt and some people want extra spelt and somebody wants no oats. And so I'd like a bulletin board where people can actually trade with each other without me or this group having to be involved in that.
I'm getting the same kinds of questions too, Brenda. So
let's get a way that they communicate amongst themselves to do their swapping.
Or like you say, you're going to do a newsletter or a recipe sheet or an insert in their bin. get them to try it. You know, it's not bad.
Exactly. But I mean, for those who can eat wheat, for example, and that want to swap with someone, then I'd like to take us out of the picture and just use the conduit of a website bulletin board to let people. And I don't like giving out other people's phone numbers and emails, so I'd rather have somebody post that they're looking for somebody to swap with this, and somebody can find that, and they can match themselves up, and then they have the opportunity on that bulletin board. If they get Hushcroft wheat and somebody else has Galeas wheat, and if they want to swap half a bag, great. You know,
I think it's important in terms of consumer education to also clue in to people that the red, they might not be able to eat conventional wheat that everybody eats the only variety, but they might be able to tolerate the red fife just fine, because Camelot and Spelt are both wheats as well. So the likelihood of them also being able to tolerate the red fife if they can handle the other two is probably fairly high.
Good point.
There was also discussion around whether or not the grain should instead be supplied in bulk the following year, with members supplying their own containers for or bags for the grain. You're listening to part three of the Local Grain Revolution series on Deconstructing Dinner. If you missed part one or two of the series, they have both been archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. On today's episode, we're listening in on the July 14th meeting of the CSA Steering Committee, with the hope that this new and innovative project can provide a resource for other communities wishing to take on a similar model. But before we get back to the meeting that took place in Creston, let's first travel to Nelson, where 75% of the CSA members call home. Located within Nelson city limits is David Everest, who since first hearing about the CSA in late 2007, came forward and volunteered to become the Nelson-based miller. In other words, when members receive their whole grains in late October, they'll have the option of taking their grain once a week to David's home, where he's offered to mill those grains into flour. I caught up with David in the backyard of his home on September 27th, where he was in the process of building a shed that would soon be the home for his mill. Now, it was only during my visit with David that I realized how synchronistic my visit to his new shed was, because David was the key volunteer who recently led a team of other volunteers to build our new radio station here in Nelson at Kootenai Co-op Radio. And so there I was recording David in a shed that he was building for the Grain CSA, which would shortly be broadcast from this very radio station where I now sit, that David also had an important hand in constructing. I guess one of the nice stories is the connection between this, you building this shed for the Grain CSA, is that you also were pretty integral in building the radio station that will be airing the show about your shed that you're building.
Well, I love to build things.
So what left do you have to do in here?
Just to finish off the wiring. The rough wiring's all in, and get some light here and power. It's one of those ideas, you know, that you get or dreams that you have, and then you realize other people are having the same idea or the same dream.
So what was your dream?
Well, just that we could grow. I actually tried once growing wheat in my garden, and the rabbits ate it all. but it grows. It's like a no-brainer. If you start thinking 100-mile diet and you can't have grains... Mm-hmm. I exist on grains. I love bread. My mother told me bread was my first word when I started talking. And I started baking bread on a small scale. I would bake for our family, and then I got in touch with someone. He called himself the Barefoot Baker. He came through the Kootenays here a few years ago and helped people build ovens and things. And so I built an oven, a brick oven, in my backyard, and was using it to bake for the family, and then I started thinking, well, this could be a business. So I built it up into a business. Eventually, the first oven I built was too small, and then I built a 36 loaf, and did it as a part-time job, especially in the winter. It was a good business.
So now you've taken on a pretty significant role as part of the Grain CSA. What's your role going to be once these grains are ready?
Well, that remains to be seen. How many people, I don't know how many people have their own little grain mill, but anyone who doesn't, I will grind. I've got from my bakery, I've still got my stone mill, and it's ever been used for is organic grains.
So we're standing out here in front of a shed that How long have you been constructing the shed here?
Oh, it's been, I've been a couple of weeks working on it. Yeah.
And has this shed, has the purpose of this shed been for your mill?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this will be a milling shed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seemed better to do it this way than to do it sort of in my house. It's, the milling is noisy.
Yeah.
So we'll keep it out here, we'll keep it isolated and keep everything clean. Mm-hmm. It's like a single purpose. Mm-hmm.
So what's the hope, that members will come here whenever they want, or will there be a set schedule?
I think we'll try and keep it to one day a week, and that day is yet to be determined. It's going to be arbitrary, and it probably won't suit everybody. But I'm thinking Friday right now. Then the weekend bakers can have fresh flour for the weekend. I imagine it more that I'll build a dry box out by my front door. People in the morning will drop off their pail with their grain in it and what they, you know,
how much they want.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and then you'll leave it for them.
It'll be quite obvious. You know, they'll just have their name on the pail and they'll just want it ground. And then I'll put it back out in the box and they'll pick it up later that day.
So for you, building this shed and doing this with your mill has been just something out of passion, eh? I mean, it's a it's a volunteer effort.
At 15 cents a pound, I'm not going to make my fortune. But it you know, I keep my hand in. And I'm always grinding grain for myself, so why not do it for other people too?
So you say you do have your mill here somewhere.
Oh, it's in the basement right now.
It's in the basement.
Through that doorway?
Yeah. Should we go check it out quickly?
Sure. Uh-huh. Lights off down here. So, just a fairly big hopper on the top here. You put the grain in, and this controls the feed.
So it's pretty small. It's about the size of a television set.
Yeah, something like that. But it's heavy.
It's heavy.
It's all I can do to pick it up and walk around with it. So it's, you know, it's got to be 160 pounds or something like that. Mm-hmm.
And what's the story behind this? Was this made locally or?
It comes from Denmark. It came air freed over from Denmark right to Nelson. I had a smaller mill before and it just was not keeping up to what I needed.
So.
Mm-hmm.
So how much can this mill do in one go?
Let's see. I'm trying to remember. It's been a while since I've used it because it was loaned out there. But I think it grinds about a pound every 20 seconds or something like that. So
So it's going to be a quick process for people.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
And what is the mechanism in here that's actually going to be grinding?
There are two stones. The fixed one is on top, and the lower one, it raises and lowers to get the fineness of flour. So, and then whatever that is, a 2-horsepower motor or something. And it grinds it into this pail here.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, and you're listening to a recording of my visit with David Everest, the Nelson, British Columbia resident who has volunteered to become the local miller for the members of Canada's first community-supported agriculture project for grain. And before we continue listening in on segments from the July 14th meeting of the Grain CSA Steering Committee that we were listening to just earlier, here's one more segment from my visit to David Everest's backyard. While I was there, I inquired into why the shed he was building was so much larger than the mill itself. And upon hearing his response, it became quite clear that David is thinking well into the future of what exciting possibilities are in store for this CSA project. You had another idea that you were talking about at one point, too, about having a silo back here, right, for grains?
Well, I was thinking, when I was thinking of rebuilding my garage, which was in that spot right there, that I would build it with a flat roof and put a grain silo on top. And also maybe an oil press.
Wow,
because that's one reason why I made that bigger. So I thought, well, if we ever get into pressing oil...
Mm-hmm. Like what kind of oils are you thinking?
Sunflower, whatever we can grow around.
Flax or...
Yeah, hemp.
Hemp, yeah.
Anything that's pressable for oil. Because, it's...
That's great.
A few thousand bucks for an oil press. But that's something that I don't know where we would get oil if we're trying to eat locally.
And that was David Everest, a Nelson, British Columbia resident who, along with being integral in building our new radio station here at Kootenai Co-op Radio, is also now finishing up the shed where members of Canada's first grain CSA will be able to take their grain each week. They'll be able to bring their whole grains and be milled into flour. You're tuned in to Deconstructing Dinner, a weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. We always appreciate it when those of you devoted listeners help spread the word about our show, and you can do so by directing colleagues, friends, or family to our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. We also encourage speaking with your local independent radio stations to encourage them to air our weekly broadcasts. Later on today's show, we'll briefly meet with another enthusiastic volunteer who has too been inspired by the Grain CSA. Jay of the Kootenai Lake Sailing Association was so enthusiastic about the CSA that he gathered a group of other sailing enthusiasts to travel to Creston on the weekend of October 25th to haul some of the grain back to Nelson via sailboat. But before we hear from Jay, let's come back to the July 14th meeting of the CSA that took place in Creston, only a day after the tour when members first visited with the farmers and the grain. Among the topics that we've already heard discussed, there was also talk about seed saving and how much seed should be saved for the following year. There was also talk about the incredible demand and interest from businesses and residents who are eager to become part of the CSA. Some of the CSA organizers have felt overwhelmed by this demand, and Farmer Keith Huscroft raised the question.
When do we get to the point where how big do you think the CSA is going to get? I don't know how much of your land are you willing to put into grain every year?
I'm not really willing to go too much bigger because I want to sort of be able to grow some other...
How about you?
Mm-hmm. I have 60 acres to do something.
Okay. And I'm going to max out about 20 on that piece, though I do have rental pieces I could do, but I'm not really excited about doing it if I'm doing it with horses, because I want to stick. So we're only talking, even if we're talking 80 acres, I don't know how many. If it grew tenfold, you've already outgrown us, even if we all went to the max.
Now, this important question of growth will be expanded upon at the next meeting of the CSA, so you can stay tuned to learn more about how big the CSA will grow into next year. But another important topic of discussion that took up a significant part of the meeting was structure. How should the CSA be structured, and should it become a more formal entity instead of what it is right now, which is simply a group of eaters, farmers, and one business? Abra Brin, who has been involved in the local food movement and the administration of cooperatives for quite some time, lent her thoughts on what she thought should happen with the CSA structure. Abra believes that the farmers should develop their own cooperative that is separate from the CSA itself. Here's the chair of the meeting, Donna Carlisle.
So we have an hour or a bit to talk about what we're going to do in the future, and one of the things that we talked about is forming a cooperative, a legal entity, and how that would work. If we want an advisory board, if we want a coordinator, how do we carry on with the values of the CSA, and, you know, is there a business model that we can do? And talking about the advantages and disadvantages overall. And, of course, Abra is our resident expert on cooperatives. Is that
I don't really assume the role of expert about really anything, but have a lot of experience with the Kootenai Co-op and with exploring agricultural co-ops as a possible business form that could be a benefit to farmers. From observing various types of co-ops who have a different kinds of members, I personally feel that a co-op has a greater possibility of success when all those who are shareholders have the same basic need and vision for that entity. So, for instance, there was a co-op that was formed on Salt Spring Island where they attempted to have consumers and the farmers all be members and then make it move forward effectively where they're all benefiting. But the pressure on the farmers to have low prices was quite intense, and I don't know if it's still struggling along or not, but I know it was a real challenge. I'm not actually in favor of trying to do that thing. Like, I do think the link with the consumers, with educating them, is really important, but you all know most people don't really have a clue about what it really is to farm. And so it could muddy the process. It could make it much more difficult to just simply move forward in the direction that you need to. So I think that it makes the most sense for the farmer producers to be the only members of this co-op. I mean, you could have an administrative support that would basically be a paid position or something along those lines, and that paid pay could be compensation in food or something.
Like, it doesn't have to be a cash exchange. It could be, here's your ton of grain for the year, dear, or something like that. So I would encourage you, I know that you don't, most of the farmers I've ever worked with hate paperwork. A certain amount of paperwork is necessary to maintain an organization like this, and there are other ways to make it happen other than just a monetary exchange, because I know that's not, you may have a lot of grain, but you may not have a lot of cash for it.
Also at the table was CSA Administrator Matt Lowe, who asked ABRA what advantages a farmer cooperative would have.
I'm not in favor of arbitrarily forming another society, another co-op, another council, another whatever. They seem to sprout out up quite frequently and often die a natural death. However, for your purposes, I mean, I don't know how well the three of you work together, how well all of your different farming values coalesce or not, but the three of you have all committed to participating in this CSA. So there's enough commonality that you're working together this year, but being really clear, by forming a co-op, for me, the benefit for you three and anyone else who wanted to join to expand the production would be being really clear on the boundaries, being really clear on the expectations about what you're each doing and what you're providing and what's acceptable and not acceptable farm practices and stuff like that. Because, I mean, just word of mouth and trust may be just fine, but where there are some problems, and, I mean, farmers by nature, you have to be pretty, you know, it's a tough business. And so most of the farmers I know are fairly ornery and opinionated. So, you know, having... I don't know, maybe you're not at all. But just having those real clear boundaries, it makes things a lot easier. So to me, that would be the advantage of a co-op. It doesn't have to be particularly onerous to set up. There's a co-op act. You can take your bylaws right out of it.
So I'm confused here. You don't want to have anything to do with the CSA? Or the CSA is a different entity from the co-op?
The CSA would be one of the products of the farmers in this co-op. So, like, let me just jump ahead to lower down. A lot of CSAs, and I'm sure Cindy can correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of them supply their shareholders, but they also will have other market outlets on the side. So it's quite possible. I actually think it would not be good to incorporate businesses into the CSA, although I know Au Soleil Levant currently is. But there's challenges with trying to bring in a business that's going to want that much more volume of product than a consumer and how you make that work. But there'd be no reason why you as a co-op couldn't be going for a CSA where you start out the year just as you did this year. We're growing so many acres, we have an expectation it will be approximately this volume, and each member will get approximately this based on Mother Nature. Separate from that, you've thrown in another 10 acres of whatever that you'll make available to Jenny and to Cindy and whoever based on the crop. And what you would do with your commercial contracts, like you could enter into a contract agreement in advance of the season so that they know those 10 acres are theirs, whatever it produces. And you know those 10 acres are theirs, whatever it produces. And you might negotiate a price or try and set something in advance in terms of some kind of security.
Get me if I'm wrong. If the CSA involves all these different parties, in it, including the farmers, then shouldn't we have like a board of directors that are overseeing where this is going to go? You know, what? Not everybody from the Food Atchison Coalition is here, just a representative. So there would be a farmer representative here who we are still part of the CSA, but we are to deal with us. We'll have a co-op where we'll look after. I don't kind of understand. Like, I mean, what I'm getting at is here we have three farmers. If it's going to grow like it's supposed to grow, I don't suspect that there's going to be three farmers here next year. There's going to be more. Who decides who these farmers are going to be? What criteria are we going to let on? Where are we headed with this? Like, where, you know, if we start adding too much and all of a sudden the farming philosophy in our co-op isn't our farming philosophy, we're outvoted.
But that's the advantage of having the legal structure, because what Eber was saying is you've got bylaws that you have to write.
Yeah, but that we would write.
Well, yeah.
Because, I mean,
a board.
Okay, or a board would write, whatever.
Well, they can start out being the board.
But I mean, yeah, I don't need to know all the technical, but is that sort of where we're headed?
So I'd like to just unpack it a little bit, and I'm sorry if I've mix it up too much so that it's a bit confusing. I mean, you each individually are interested in growing a small-scale production of grain, which is a really interesting idea. You have various market options as small-scale grain producers.
What I see you forming would be a co-op of small-scale grain producers who could have various market options, one of which would be a CSA. And I think your point about, you know, making the decisions about how the CSA goes, grows, expands, what all would be produced, etc., it is good to have that kind of diversity of representation at some level on a board or council or whatever you want to call it, having those kinds of discussions. But in terms of small-scale grain producers, farmers, you forming that co-op and then participating in the CSA and participating in contracts with, you know, your various retail options, etc., commercial options, that would be something that might be to your benefit to be working collaboratively. And then if the CSA came to you and said, hey, look, we've grown tenfold, can we negotiate for you guys planting more volume dedicated to the CSA, then you as a co-op could look at a membership drive to expand your production base, could look at cutting back your commercial vendors in order to support the CSA, saying to the CSA, sorry, this is all we're willing to produce for you at this point. But it would be you as farmers making those decisions about what's in your best interest for your business viability.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner. You've been listening to Abra Brin sharing her thoughts at the July 14th meeting of the Nelson Creston Grain Community Supported Agriculture Project. Among the many issues discussed at the meeting was what form the CSA should take as it evolves from its first year of operation. Now, two things that stand out from Abra's suggestions were the formation of a farmer cooperative that is separate from the CSA members, and the other was the ability for the farmers to then access other markets, such as businesses, that is, keeping businesses and members separate. Now, as someone who was also at the meeting to lend my own thoughts, I did have my reservations regarding such suggestions. I do believe that a cooperative where eaters and farmers are part of the same entity can indeed work, and so I did share my opinion with the group.
If I could just make maybe two observations. One is just to sort of revisit what founded this group in the first place, which was to create a model that would link eaters up with farmers, and that's the CSA model. And just from this conversation in the past maybe 40 minutes or so, I'm hearing two meetings. I'm hearing a meeting of a formation of a farmer co-op, and I'm not hearing a meeting about the CSA. Not that they both can't happen at the same time, but, you know, it was said early on in the beginning of the meeting that having a cooperative where there's farmers and eaters as part of the membership may, you know, hasn't worked in the past in many examples, which is true, and likely wouldn't again. I would disagree with, because I think if this group is working right now where there's farmers and eaters together, then there's, in my opinion, no reason why a co-op wouldn't work so long as those values can be maintained. And I think it's clear to me in this room that all of us are going down the exact same path. There's not much resistance in that. So I envision, you know, when it comes to a co-op, and I know when initially I was speaking with Matt about this, I would envision a cooperative consisting of, as members of the co-op, farmers, the CSA as a representative, and businesses as also part of that cooperative, all working together as the co-op. And it introduces something that I was talking as well with Brenda about yesterday, which is this idea of retail-supported agriculture, where the business, just like Osley Laval, essentially they are retail-supported agriculture. They've taken the risk of investing 20 shares into the co-op. They were paying a little less per share because of the volume. And I think that's the route as well that businesses need to start taking. And I know, you know, I come from a business background. If I was operating a grocery store, a bakery, or a restaurant, I would be more secure investing and taking the risk in this kind of CSA, in this kind of program, than I would being reliant on the systems of food distribution right now and those rising prices and potentially 2 months from now, my grain being, you know, twice as much as it is today. I would rather, as a business owner, invest a year before or 6, 7, 8 months before that crop is ready to be assured that I'm going to have that crop down the road. And what that means is businesses have to start planning a little more in advance. And that's the direction I think naturally that businesses are going to have to take. It's not going to be about just filling out the order form when you need something to fill the shelves. It's going to be about, you know, investing in futures, investing, you know, down the road to ensure that you're going to have stuff on your shelves. And so I do think that the idea of a retail supported agriculture model, which is the same thing as what you've created for members, could work. I share some of the comments that have been made that, like, let's just not grow so quickly that it just starts to replicate the same models that have been existing, because that is incredibly easy. It's like we all know how to ride a bike, and you know, we hop onto a unicycle and we're going to have trouble doing that because we've been riding those two wheels the whole time. It's just natural that we're going to be operating that way. You know, and I've seen it. I've seen cooperatives look just like any other business, you know, that do lose their values.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner. Now, we will get a chance to hear from the farmers what their current thoughts are on what structure the CSA should take in the future. But first, let's come to another interesting topic that arose throughout the meeting, and it runs along a similar vein. As I suggested at the meeting, there are indeed risks when launching an alternative model of anything, that model can very easily resort back to the same conventional models that in the case of food are clearly not working. This brings us to the issue of maintaining the values and the vision that formed the CSA in the first place. Here's Gail Southall sharing a comment she received from a Creston fruit producer. Farmer Keith Huscroft responds.
One of the fruit producer that I talked to in the valley said what she would really like to see. She says, I see a trend. Everybody used to grow apples, and then cherries became popular. Everybody rips out their apples and plants cherries. She says, now we hardly have any apples in the valley. She said, if we are going to truly feed ourselves, then wouldn't it be nice if our producers could get together and say, well, you grow corn because you have the best land for that, and why don't you grow this, and I'll grow this because I've got the best setup for that. And that way, we're not all trying to compete with each other, rather working cooperatively.
Mm-hmm.
Which is exactly what the model of agriculture is right now, except they're undercutting or whatever. To me, that's a step back monoculture. Yeah, I'll grow the apples, you grow the cherries, you grow the beef. To me, it's everybody can grow a little bit of everything. I mean, maybe it's, you know, I'm off in left field and it's just not attainable. But you are not working synergistically by growing apples. All of a sudden you have your apples there and you say, by God, you know, we got a moth problem. We got to spray or we're going to lose it. Got to spray. Well, I'm sorry, but if we're going to make a difference, and maybe, you know, I should just go home and not worry about it, or I'm having illusions of grandeur or whatever it is, that we can actually do something different here. I think we got to do it different. I think it's, you know, if you got a system where you can grow, everybody can grow a little bit of everything, you've spread the risk. Mm-hmm. And if everybody had a little orchard and did a little cider here, fed it to their pigs there, did whatever, you have 10 different things coming off your farm. If something goes wrong on all the farms, even one different thing, it's all covered. We are covered. Into the future, we're covered. You're not going to go to Costco and make up the difference because Costco's not going to be there. Or is that our vision? Or are we just trying to make money and we're competing with the same marketplace because we have the same models? That's not what I want to do. I'm not going to do that. I mean, I'm not interested. They're educated in the agriculture of today. And I mean, you can't... It's in this model, I think we have to be... We're looking at things being different, you know, or at least that's why I was drawn to this CSA, is because the charter, it seemed to me, was towards sustainability, a peak oil civilization or a no oil civilization. Are we going to work to that, or are we going to, where are we going?
Now, one idea that Keith Huscroft used was that of a charter, and he later addressed this idea of how the CSA can ensure that regardless of the direction the CSA takes, the vision and values will be maintained.
But I'm just saying, when it gets larger, it gets harder to control. And what are, so if we start the co-op with a mandate that says this is where we're headed off into fantasy land, what might seem like now, but will work later, because if we do it, and we make it work, we have, because I, like you said, I've seen all those excited faces. Mm-hmm. We have a market. We could make it work. You know, they're not going to buy off us if they can buy exactly the same thing by walking down the street. If they see something unique and they taste something they've never tasted before, which means you have to keep it really small, because you can't raise a milk-fed, 2,000 milk-fed pigs. You know, you can get away with a dozen, and you can get, you know, or whatever. I'm just saying, it's going to be, not all the members are going to get all the products. It's going to be, how you figure it out, I don't know, but yeah, I guess you just keep jacking the price till you got 12 people left. You know, honestly.
I guess that's
one. You know, I mean, that's one. But I mean, because it is a unique, I'm saying we are going to offer something very unique. You know, I've raised, all of us as farmers have raised animals or crops or something that are very, very, you know, high, very high quality, but took an amazing amount of labor or time to do, and to put it out there in the free market and say, if a baker comes to me in my wheat and I just
played with my horses all summer on that stuff, and it's going to be a low volume. And they say, well, this is the market value for wheat. I can go to Alberta and I can buy bread wheat for $500 a ton. You know, I expect that price from you. Then I'm sorry, I should have just left my horses in the barn, because I can't compete with someone who's doing 25 sections a wheat when I'm doing a unique. And I'm not saying that my product, it should be a little better, but maybe it isn't. I mean, maybe when it's all said and done, their wheat's going to taste just the same as my wheat. But I'm doing something different, something unique in this area, and it's local. And yeah, it's not going to be the same, and I can't compete on a global level if that is sort of where we're headed. You know, I'm just going to park it right now because I'm not interested.
You see the CSA as that natural entity to purchase your product.
Yeah, and I see it as...
Okay.
Yeah, but it's your, you know, you've got the connection. We have a connection with... We can't go to 20,000 people. I don't know what we're going to go to, but for who we are right here and right now, I think that there's a tremendous opportunity to do just about anything we ever want to do on a quality level.
Now, when all was said and done, it was clear that the meeting had created more questions than it did answering the ones that the meeting started out with. To wrap up the meeting, everyone in the room shared their final thoughts. And here's a clip starting with Farmer Roy Lawrence, followed by CSA Administrator Matt Lowe and Farmers Drew Galeas and Keith Huscroft.
I can kind of see where the Farmer Co-op could take some of the responsibility off the CSA, but I can't see them being two separate entities. So I'm hoping that we can work this out, and so that we're still very much integrated together.
I always come here with hoping that we're going to get some clear-cut answers. And I always go away realizing that they just create more questions. But to me, that means that we've had a good meeting. That you know, we've really sunk our teeth into the issues more and more. And I think this group is working really well. We're really moving along. And with each meeting, I feel like it does bring us to the next stage. And it's been great.
Yeah, I'm very happy with how things are going. I think it's a lot of hard work. We have a lot of decisions, hard decisions to make. And I see the co-op, as Roy, as a small part to help the farmers work better. But within the CSA, because I really believe in the CSA model. I really believe that people finding out about their food, and I like that community it makes. And I think that's really worth working towards. And I think everybody in this room has, I think, the same idea, and that's it's a good feeling. So I'm happy, and I think we have lots of work to do, but I'm very happy with it, and I'd like to continue it basically the same way, with maybe a few minor changes, but continue along.
I like to be wrapped in the womb of the CSA, because last time I left the womb, it was a lot of work.
Not for you.
I'll leave it at that.
Thank you.
The average cable or satellite TV bill runs a viewer $45 per month.
The average daily newspaper subscription, $30.
Internet, $35.
Magazine subscription, $30.
A book a month, $24.95.
Deconstructing Dinner's weekly one-hour episodes, free.
We believe in media being accessible to everyone, regardless of income. And for those of you who are able to support this radio project, please donate when you can or become a voluntary monthly subscriber by visiting deconstructingdinner.ca. Or for more information on how to send a check or money order, call 250-352-9600.
Deconstructing Dinner, helping ensure a perpetual harvest.
A reminder that if you missed any of today's show or would like to listen in on parts one or two of this Local Grain Revolution series, you can access these shows through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. Now, as mentioned earlier, a pretty exciting stage in the evolution of this groundbreaking grain CSA took place only a few weeks ago. It appears that some local residents who learned about the CSA through local media have decided to lend their skills and resources to the CSA as well, and have offered to take a fleet of sailboats down to the southern shores of Kootenay Lake and load up as much grain as they can and sail it back to Nelson fossil fuel free. Now, this was an idea that had been floated around when the CSA was first formed, but it was unexpected that it would happen so soon. And what this new development helps capture is just how impactful the move towards more localized food systems can be in bringing a community of people together. What's essentially happening here is that a local food system, or a segment of a local food system, is building itself from the ground up. All it took was one eater, Matt Lowe, who was seeking out local grain, and what followed was a team of local food advocates, three farming families, and a local bakery. We've now since met David Everest, who we heard from earlier on the show and who stepped up to the task of milling the grain into flour for Nelson residents. There are also other bakeries, restaurants, and grocery stores, all expressing an interest in becoming involved. And now here we have the transportation of the grain finding its place within this local food system. And the most beautiful thing of it all is that, for the most part, everyone is coming forward simply out of the passion to see a thriving local food system. No one's doing it out of greed or out of an interest to make a quick dollar. This truly is a community coming together. On October 7th, Jay was invited into our studios here at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Jay is with the Kootenai Lake Sailing Association and is the sailor who spearheaded this idea. Jay was a guest on another one of our shows here at Kootenai Co-op Radio, The Ecocentric, a weekly one-hour production put on by the West Kootenai Eco Society. And so here's Jay sharing how he first heard about the grain CSA and how the idea arose of sailing the grain from Creston to Nelson.
Kelly and I are fairly new to town. Basically, the first I'd heard about it was when the newspaper articles here locally came out. And, you know, it sounded like a great idea, and we spoke about getting involved with it the following season. And then I didn't really think too much about it more as the summer went along until I saw more articles that it was a success and the farmers that were coming across with quite a crop. And I started thinking that the whole idea of folks getting their food locally, more sustainably, and with a smaller footprint, why not use the transportation corridors that we have occurring naturally, you know, with the lake? And by that time, we'd been out sailing a lot this summer. We sailed up to Caslow Jazz Fest and spent several days up there, and were able to sail almost the entire way, except for a little bit past Kootenai Park there. We had to motor. So it just seemed like a natural progression to why not try and get some more folks locally involved with the community, especially from the Kootenai Lake Sailing Association. It seemed like a natural progression to think about bringing a cargo back rather than just getting out there, for fun.
Jay also shares some of the details of this trip.
First off, we couldn't do it without the other members of the Kootenai Lake Sailing Association. So we put it out there to them and got an enthusiastic response. So I think we have right now potentially six boats going that can carry anywhere from 500 pounds to 1,000, 1,500 pounds each. So we're hoping right now to bring back potentially, 5,000 pounds worth of the grain. All of the skippers and the boats are experienced out on the West Arm here in the main lakes. So I feel that we're, capable of handling any of the conditions that do arise. They're the group that's going are really enthusiastic. Anytime you get more than two boats out on the lake, there's a race. So there's going to be a little bit of competition heading the way down. And then typically the winds, are out of the south leaving Creston, so that would be a downwind run to Balfour. So we're hoping for winds, and with it getting a little later in the season here, we anticipate that especially on the main lake, we should be able to have some good sailing in. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, I anticipate this is going to turn out really well. So I think we'll just generate more enthusiasm and support for it for next year and following years. Mm-hmm. Seems like we're seeing more and more sailboats out on the lakes. So, the more folks we can get involved, and it just seemed like a great way to involve the Sailing Association with the community at large. Mm-hmm. And I hope it's something we can build on.
And that was Jay of the Kootenai Lake Sailing Association. The fleet of sailboats will be departing Nelson on Friday, October 24th, and loading up their cargo of grain in Kuskanook, not too far north of Creston, on Saturday the 25th. And then they'll return to Nelson on Sunday the 26th. And you can expect more information on the trip in local media. And CSA organizers are hoping for a crowd of people to come out on Sunday the 26th in Nelson to celebrate the arrival of the grain. And you can, of course, be sure that Deconstructing Dinner will be on board one of the boats so that all of you can also be part of this exciting formation of this local food system. And so to end off today's part three of the Local Grain Revolution series, I'd like to end with some final important and moving last words from farmer Keith Huscroft. These were recorded back in July.
But we have to change how we look at farming. we have to go, the models that have been, you know, of monoculture, just wheat or whatever, have been proven that they just, it just doesn't work. You have to have, you know, it has to be diverse. If we have 2,000 members, I just can't go out and rent 200 acres, even though it's organic, and say, man, I'm getting into the grain. That's not what I want to do. I want to work with my horses, but in order to work with them, there's a synergistic way, and I mean, there's models out there where they've got a small, they've got 10 different things working in court with everything, so that the end result is, you know, pre-work compost. You have hogs that work the horse manure into a compost that you put on your fields or whatever, but you have to have sale for that. You have to, everything has to be able to provide an income for it all to work. Do we, you know, where do we want our society to go? You know, I'm excited about it, but I think it's just unbelievable what we've created, because you know, it's a whole people with the same mindset who, if you treat them properly, and they're looking for change, they want change, and we have to be there. We have to be the change. We can't just go ahead and do it the way everybody else is doing it, saying it's organic. We're not going to do it with fossil fuels. We're going to figure out a way to get around that, because it's the cost of equipment and fuel is just freaking phenomenal, unbelievable. To where the point where I don't care what they're paying us, it's going to be hard to make a living, because then they're talking about it going up more. It's to the point now where my tractor's for sale. You know, even if I only do the garden, I'm just had enough of paying that kind of money. I really think it's important, no matter how long it takes us, is that we really get a direction of a charter or whatever it is, of where this is going to take us in the next generation. Because I'm really excited about this, because I can see a potential for me hauling one of my kids home and take over that farm. Because, you know, it'd be nice to have sixth generation on there. Or, I mean, I got generation seventh playing on the farm, but he ain't working because he's like this big. But I mean, I'm excited about maybe there is a future for my family, because if this does not work, I guarantee you, as soon as they plant me, the farm's for sale. Mm-hmm. And then it'll be gone. Just like every farm around me, that's what they're waiting for death. All the kids are waiting for the funeral, and not one of them, there's not one person who's around me, is going to stay farming. Not to say that they might not get it. 20 excited younger farmers in there, which might be the best thing. Split it all up, but the big farms are going down, and more than likely it's people from Alberta are going to come and retire and put a horse out front.
And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio program is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.